get this going here then. And we are here with our guest, Jack Cole, who is a former New Jersey State Police detective for 26 years, and 14 of those years was spent in narcotics in the undercover division. He has a BA in criminal justice and a PhD in public policy. So, Jack, how did you get involved with LEAP and start this organization? If you could tell us, please.
Well, before we do that, let me correct one thing. Okay. I don't have a PhD in public policy, although I spent 7 years working on it. But at one point, at the end, when I had left to do was write my dissertation, somebody offered us $50,000 to any police organization of current or former cops who would call for the decriminalization of 1 ounce of marijuana. That was the Marijuana Policy Project that did that. Well, and I just felt like I could no longer justify my trying to get a PhD when what I was intending to write about was what I could actually be doing in real life.
Right. Well, basically, you got the education. You just don't have the piece of paper.
That's true.
Which knowledge is a wonderful thing. Huh. So when did that start? With the decriminalization of an ounce of marijuana?
And that Well, actually, that never started, because what happened was we created LEAP, and I got a hold of Marijuana Policy Project and told them not only would we call for the decriminalization of an ounce of marijuana, we would call for the legalization and regulation of all drugs, and pretty much scared the pants off them. It was a toss-up as to whether they were going to give us the money then, and they ended up giving it to us, but they also gave $50,000 to some sheriffs out west who I guess were never heard of again. And what we did with our $50,000 was we created Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. It's an organization that was created by 5 founding members, all of us former cops, and today it numbers well over 50,000 members, police, judges, prosecutors, prison wardens, DEA, FBI agents, and supporters in 86 countries.
Hmm. So, as far as the other countries go, what countries have you gone to, and are their beliefs any different than your own, or how's it working as far as drug policies in other countries?
Well, Tim, let me explain what we are and what we do. We're strictly a speakers bureau. Mm-hmm. We have about 170 speakers now, and anybody can join LEAP. And we think everybody should, because the only way we're going to change these laws is to get a tremendously large grassroots organization to demand it. But it can't just be a grassroots organization. It has to be a credible grassroots organization. And we think that's where we really shine, and it is in credibility. So when we go to speak, because of our credibility, because it's cops, judges, and prosecutors saying these things, about 80% of our audience is convinced immediately by our argument. And that's changing many, many minds throughout the world. And that occurs no matter where we are in the United States or no matter where I go in the world, and I've been in 24 different countries now. Excuse me. New Zealand, Australia, Thailand, most of the countries in Europe, Albania, in South America. I've been to Brazil and going to Mexico next month, Mexico City. We're trying to start a LEAP chapter there. And our reception is wonderful. And much better in other countries than it is here, actually.
Hmm. And why do you think that is?
Well, because this is sort of the belly of the beast. We are in the country that instigated the war on drugs. I mean, it was the United States that started all this stuff, and it was the United States that the UN to pass the 1961 Single Convention Against Dangerous Drugs, which is pretty much an international treaty, has that effect. And what it says basically is any drugs that are considered illegal by the United States are also considered illegal in our country. So countries around the world would really like to change this, but they're very worried about us. They're worried because they know that, for one thing, we have a law that says the countries of South America and Central America have to toe the line every year. They're judged on whether what kind of job they did in drug interdiction in the last year before we will give them any money at all and any support whatsoever. And these other countries understand that if they were to legalize drugs, we might even come down on them with economic sanction.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Something to worry about.
No, but let me tell you, Tim, they've done wonderful things in some of these other countries. And, of course, the reason that we at LEAP go to the other countries is because that is a very good way for us to put pressure on the United States to change its laws. Because if we can get these other countries to reduce some of these repressive laws and the sky doesn't fall on them, then each time they do that, it removes some of the reasons that the U.S. can say that we need drug prohibition in this country. Many countries have already decriminalized drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Six of them have decriminalized all drugs for adults, actually.
Really?
And the first country to do any decriminalization, as I'm sure you know, was the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
They decriminalized marijuana for adults back in 1976. So that's, what, 36 years ago?
Yep.
They've got a long history, and their history is exceptionally good. When you look back at the statistics from the Netherlands and compare it with the statistics from the United States, they're a shining example. For instance, they're 10th graders, where in the Netherlands, where marijuana might as well be legal because you can walk into a coffee shop and get all you want. They mm-hmm. sell it to you now 3 grams at a time. And you, as many times as you want to walk in, nobody is keeping track. But their 10th graders over there, 28% of them have tried marijuana, where this drug is virtually legal. And in our country, where marijuana is treated as the devil's own weed, 41% of our 10th graders have tried it. And when you look at the overall statistic, the per capita use of soft drugs in the Netherlands, marijuana, hashish, is one half the per capita use of those soft drugs in the United States. And the per capita use of hard drugs, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, is one-fourth of what it is in the United States. And when we talk to the people in charge over in the Netherlands, like their drug czar, who happens to be their minister of health, because over there they treat drug abuse as a health problem, not a crime problem. When you talk to him about it, you learn that they believe that the reason the use of hard drugs is so much less than it is in the United States is because when young people, 20, 21 years old, which are the main users of the drugs, decide they want to use a soft drug, they can go into a coffee shop where the people want to sell them the soft drugs, marijuana and hashish. They don't have to go to a criminal on the street corner who would much rather hook them on these hard drugs so they're guaranteed a customer long term.
Right. I mean, I feel it's pretty similar to the idea of drinking in the United States. I mean, it's 21. In a lot of countries, it's 18, 19, or even lower. And it's the forbidden fruit. It's like, okay, it's illegal, therefore it must be something good. And it puts people in situations where they tend to binge because they don't know when they're going to get it again. again, the forbidden fruit, and then they end up doing too much, and they create health problems for themselves and addictions that maybe not might not would have happened if it would have been legal in the first place, where you can go to places like a coffee shop or a bar and basically learn to be responsible with your habits, I guess, so to speak. And I feel that's one of the biggest problems in the country, because you're saying don't do it, which makes a lot of people, especially younger people, want to do it, and then before you know it, they have a problem. And I've seen that time and time again.
I agree with you. Couldn't agree more. I spent a lot of time in Italy, and over there, when we go out to a restaurant with our friends, they bring their children along to the restaurant, and when the people set up the wine glasses around the table, they also set a wine glass in front of each one of the kids, and they pour like a spoon or two spoons full of wine into that glass and fill it up with water, and the children sit at the table and they learn that this is something you do in a social occasion. This is not something that people go out and get drunk over, you know. So they learn from a very young age how to use drugs responsibly.
Exactly. But okay.
You know, there's other countries too, Tim, that as a matter of fact, every country that has reduced these laws at all has found they have a better situation now than they did before they reduced the laws. Take, for instance, Portugal, which was the first country to decriminalize all drugs for adults, 18 and over. And not only did they decriminalize all drugs, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, you name it, any drug you can use there and not get arrested, but you can also have in your possession up to 10 days' supply of that drug of choice. Now, that's a very strange thing that they came up with. It's not a weight or anything. It's 10 days' supply. And as you know, 10 days' supply to you would be different than 10 days' supply to me or to the next person.
Right.
So virtually nobody gets arrested over there for drugs. And, of course, when they were getting ready to do this, the drug warriors, like myself, were saying, if you do this, it will be chaos. You'll become the drug tourist capital of the world. All your beautiful beaches, people will be afraid to walk on them because needles will be sticking out all over the place. Well, none of that happened. As a matter of fact, what did happen was drug abuse in every age category declined. But going back to what you said, Tim, about the fruit of the forbidden tree, the biggest decline was among the youngest people. For children from 13 to 15 years old, drug abuse declined by 25%. And for young folks from 16 to 18 years old, drug abuse declined by 22%. Now, those are really significant figures.
Right. I mean, it doesn't become a big deal. I mean, it's like I had a friend from South Africa, and his parents did drugs, not, I don't think, abused them, but did them, and he basically found no need to even bother. I mean, because it was there, yeah. It was available, you know, and then it becomes a choice thing, opposed to force.
Yes, and
force.
Don't get me wrong, you know, Leap, none of the people at Leap want to see one more drug abuser in the world.
Right.
We spent our entire careers trying to reduce drug abuse, and we haven't changed our mind about that. The only two things we've changed our mind about is, first, what is drug abuse? And we no longer believe drug abuse is anybody that uses a drug that is considered illegal. Just as there is responsible drug use for alcohol, tobacco, there is also responsible drug use for these illicit drugs. So we've changed our mind about that. And the second thing we've changed our mind about is how we can reduce drug abuse. You know, originally I was a great believer when I started working undercover. I thought I was going to save the world from this scourge of drugs that was going to destroy society. And I went out there and spent 14 years undercover, and I worked very hard at it. And nothing I did in my entire 26-year career in the state police reduced the number of people abusing drugs by so much as one person. But we found that if we, instead of arresting people and trying to put them in prison, destroying people's lives, removing their hope for the future, if instead we try to create situations that give them hope for the future, we'll have less drug abuse. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the one drug, one social drug that the only one that we have had any effect on reducing the number of people or the rate of abuse in 100 years happens to be the worst social drug known to human beings. It's the most addictive drug that we know of, far more addictive than heroin. And that drug, of course, is nicotine in cigarettes. In 1985, 42% of the adults in this country smoked cigarettes. And we said, we've got to stop this. We're just killing too many people with ingesting this cigarette smoke. But we didn't start a war on those people. We didn't imprison them. We started a very strong educational program. And then we pretty much regulated the smoking of cigarettes out of existence. We said, if you want to smoke, you can smoke at home. You can smoke in your car. But you can't smoke in a public place. Here in Massachusetts, you can't even smoke in a bar or a restaurant.
Yep.
And it's really worked. It's worked so well that it is more than cut the rate of cigarette use in half. It dropped from 42% in 1985 to 17% now, and is still dropping every year.
Hmm. Right, and they're afraid to smoke inside now. It's funny, because I offer to let people smoke in my house, and they go outside anyway because they just...
Well, they want to be nice.
Right,
and,
you know.
And they're thinking about the idea of slip smoke. You know, 30,000 people a year die from slip smoke even, people that don't even smoke.
Right. I mean, so what made you decide to take the path that you're on now? What was there a pivotal event in your career that made you decide that the drug policies of the United States wasn't working, or what was it?
Well, it was my career in narcotics that did it. When I started working undercover, it was the beginning of the war on drugs. It was 1970. And in 1970, looking back on it, I can see that we really didn't have much of a drug problem in the United States to speak of. What we ended up arresting people for mainly back then was marijuana violations or hashish, some psilocybin or LSD, but mainly the soft drugs. Hard drugs such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine were virtually unheard of when I started working undercover, certainly unheard of compared to what they are today.
Hmm.
And I saw this grow in every way get worse and worse, and I realized that at some point that this is not just a failure, this policy. It's far worse. It is a self-perpetuating, constantly expanding policy disaster. Every single year for 40 years, it has gotten worse than it was the year before.
So,
and once you start thinking about it, it's very easy to understand why that is. In 1965, we were arresting about 65,000 people across the United States for nonviolent drug offenses every year. 65,000. By 2005, we were arresting 1.9 million people per year for nonviolent drug offenses.
Okay.
So you can see how this has increased unbelievably. And we put so many people in prisons that for a 20-year period from 1980 to the year 2000, we created a situation where building prisons became the fastest growing industry in the United States, to the point that we can't even build prisons anymore. because we spend too much money on them. So, but we keep packing more and more nonviolent drug offenders in there. Tim, in the 40 years of the war on drugs, we have spent $1.5 trillion tax dollars on this war, and all we have to show for it is that in that 40-year period, we have made more than 41 million arrests in this country alone for nonviolent drug offenders. Think about those numbers. They're
insane.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, totally insane. So do you believe that the policy might have actually started the problem?
I believe that's exactly what happened, yes. Look, and it has had no effect whatsoever on what we wanted it to have effect on, which mm-hmm. was reducing drug addiction, right? That's the big goal. In 1914, that was the first year that we declared any of these drugs illegal on a federal level. And before 1914, the government said they did some studies, and they determined that 1.3% of the population was addicted to drugs. So they said, we can't have that. We got to make these drugs illegal. So they passed the Harrison Anti-Drug Act of 1914, making opium illegal. And in the next 56 years, they passed many, many more laws, making all these other drugs illegal. But by 1970, they were getting ready to start this war on drugs, which was a drastic step for the United States. Not only are they saying what you put in your body might make you a criminal, but now we're going to go to war against you. I mean, this was an unheard of thing. So the government needed something to hang its hat on to say, this is really important. So they did a survey, and they discovered that 1.3% of the population was addicted to drugs. Said, we can't have that. We got to start a war on drugs. Now, as I said, it's 40 years later, $1.5 trillion spent, 41 million arrests, 2.3 million people in prisons today, 7 million plus people under the authority of the government somehow under probation or parole or prison. And today, the government tells us 1.3% of the population is addicted to drugs. Zero effect we've had.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's insane. It's like the policy feeds the problem. And the funny thing is that there's really been no change of the policy except escalation. And that still doesn't seem to solve the problem at all. I mean, the problem is on the border between Mexico and the United States, the gangs in the United States. I mean, we always point to Mexico as this big problem area, but to me, the United States is the problem area. It's where the problem starts, in a sense.
Well, I agree again, Tim, with you. Something tells me I'll find much agreement with you this morning. You know, I think it was a year ago, this coming June, that our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, went to Mexico, and she made a public statement saying that the United States should take responsibility for the deaths, drug prohibition murders that are occurring in Mexico, and in the last 5 years, there's been over 50,000 of them. And I agree with that. She was right about that. But mm-hmm. I don't agree with her explanation of why we should, because she said we need to take responsibility because these drug prohibition murders are driven by the tremendous demand for drugs in the United States. Well, she was wrong about that. The drug policy murders are driven by the fact that drugs are prohibited. If all these drugs were legal and regulated, there wouldn't be one person dying in Mexico as a result of drug prohibition murders. And it wouldn't matter how much demand there is in the United States.
Right.
The murders occur because this is the way you conduct business in a world that prohibits things. You know, we saw exactly the same thing under alcohol prohibition.
Totally.
Alcohol prohibition, 1920, created organized crime, mm-hmm. raised the rate of murder in the United States to the highest rate ever in our history to that point, raised the rate of corruption of public officials, police officers, to the highest point ever to that time in history. And the day after we ended that terrible law in 1933, Al Capone and all his smuggling buddies were out of business next morning, you know. They were no longer on the streets killing each other to control that very lucrative market. They were no longer out there killing us police officers who were charged with fighting that useless war. They were no longer killing children caught in crossfire and drive-by shootings, all the things we experience today under this new prohibition. So we know that if we legalize these drugs, we can take them out of the hands of the criminals and end the violence. And then once we do that, we can do some other wonderful things by regulating these drugs. You know, we can end overdose deaths by regulating these drugs.
I can
tell you that from my 14 years of living undercover with those folks in the street, nobody dies of a drug overdose because they shoot more and more dope.
No.
They die because they don't know how much of that tiny package of powder they're buying is really the drug and how much is the cutting agent.
Right, quality control.
Get too much drug, you're dead.
Yeah.
And in an illegal market, they will never know.
Right, because basically you don't have a pharmacist cutting it and, you know, making it so every dose is the same. I mean, people either cut it too much because they want to make more money, or they don't know what they're doing and they don't really cut it at all. You know, and that gives the inconsistencies. I mean, I've met people...
Or supposing when they're making the mix, you know, you take a kilo of heroin and you mix it with maybe 7 or 8 kilos of cutting agent, the lactose, quinine, whatever they're going to use. Mm-hmm. But suppose they throw this stuff together in a big mixer and they start mixing it up and something distracts them. Maybe they hear a siren go by outside and think, oh my God, are the police coming or something. So the stuff doesn't get mixed properly. So that night, some of the people that they sell this concoction to are going to be really upset with their drug dealers. They're going to say, this guy's trying to beat me out of my money. I can't even get high. Of course, they got the part of the mix that is mostly cutting agent.
Mm-hmm.
And other people are going to get the part that is almost totally heroin. And they're dead. You know, there's no way out of that with the laws we have today.
That's sort of interesting. I never heard it put that way before. As far as the people that are dealing the drugs and cutting it also get nervous and then don't pay attention because they're paranoid of getting busted, which creates a problem all over again. And you're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, and we're here with Jack Cole, one of the co-founders of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and we're talking about legalization of drugs today. The policies confuse me because I have a friend, I have several friends in Peru, and 2 years ago, the U.S. military was sent down there with 1,000 troops to deal with the drug issues that were happening, narcotics with the coca and et cetera, et cetera. And now, 2 years later, I was talking to a friend, and he's basically saying that it's exploded. I mean, he says that Peru's production is going surpassing Colombia at this point. You know, so I have trouble when we go in to deal with a drug problem and then it gets worse. You know, it's sort of like an oxymoron. It makes no sense to me and I don't understand why that happens, you know, and unless we want there to be a problem, which then also leads to financing, you know, the military and police agencies to deal with our drug problem. It's like we almost create this problem and make it happen.
Well, in a lot of ways we do, but also there's this effect we call the balloon effect. It's like if you blow up a balloon, if you stick your finger in on one side, the balloon just gets bigger on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing that happens when you go into Peru and you try to reduce the growth of the coca there, they simply transfer that to another country, to Ecuador or to back to Colombia.
Exactly.
You know, we spent over $6 billion in Colombia trying to reduce the growth of this stuff, and that's when it moved to Peru. Now we've moved back to Mexico to do our work there, and now Peru is back growing more coca. You can't stop this stuff. There are, as the government knows, a small percentage of people that are going to use these drugs. They have always used them for all of recorded history. Humans use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you prohibit those drugs, you create this thing that we have today. Let me tell you what happens when you prohibit a drug. Any drug, doesn't matter what the drug
is. Right.
Could even be coffee. And by the way, coffee was possessing coffee in the 1500s, mid-1500s, in Eastern Europe was a capital offense, possession of coffee. You know, so there's no rhyme or reason to which drugs we even say are illegal. But what happens when you prohibit the drug? The first thing that happens is you create an underground market for it, a market that's instantly filled with criminals. And the second thing is far worse. Because the drug is prohibited, it becomes dangerous to produce and supply. You can get arrested. You can go to prison for life. You can get killed by cops or other drug dealers.
Right.
And this danger in itself creates an artificially inflated value for these drugs, a value that is so excessively huge that between where it's grown or produced, mainly in developing countries like Colombia, Peru, Mexico, and where it's sold in the United States, that value can increase by more than 17,000%. I mean, think of what an obscene profit motive this is.
Mm.
And it's because of that profit motive that I learned very early on, working undercover, that if a uniform cop arrests somebody for, say, rape or robbery in your community, the number of rapes and robberies goes down, right? You got the guy. But when I arrested somebody for selling drugs, the number of drug sales didn't change at all. I was simply creating a job opening for hundreds of people more than willing to take the risk for what they see as this obscene profit motive.
Exactly. It's like the medical marijuana in California. I mean, they're having trouble with the whole situation, and they were going for legalization last year, but there's still a profit motive in it. I mean, even in the legal places, the dispensaries, I mean, the prices are so high that people that actually need it for medicine can't afford it. You know, so again, you're hiding from the problem through the medicalization of marijuana, where people are getting the cards that don't need it for medical purposes, but, you know, taking advantage of it. So it's sort of like legalized dealing in a sense, which is regulated and stuff. But again, there's a profit margin involved in it that people don't want to get rid of. And that was a lot of reasons why I talked to people in California that they didn't want it legal, because they're worried about taxes or something like that. But, I mean, I would think the price would come down if legalized. Maybe not a whole.
Come down tremendously.
Yeah.
And by the way, Tim, in the history of the drug war, of course, there's several things that we wanted to see happen. If the drug war was working, then the supply of drugs to the United States would decrease, right?
Right.
And the potency of each particular dose of drugs would decrease because there's not enough to go around. Therefore, the price would increase. Now, none of that has happened.
Mm.
When I started doing this in 1970 in narcotics, we would measure our very largest seizures in pounds. You know, if you got a pound, a whole pound of heroin, you were a great hero back then.
Mm-hmm.
What do we measure them now in? We measure them in tons.
Tons.
Yeah. 10 tons of heroin, one seizure in the United States. 20 tons of cocaine, one seizure in the United States. 186 tons of marijuana, one seizure in the United States. So the drugs are just pouring into the country, and the potency of hard drugs. When I started buying heroin on the street in 1970, heroin was averaging, street level heroin was averaging 1.5% pure. Today, DEA tells us street level heroin is averaging 60% pure. That's a problem 40 times greater than it was at the beginning of the war.
Yeah, very much so.
And the price has dropped so dramatically for hard drugs. Cocaine, wholesale cocaine price has dropped 60% since the war started. The wholesale price for heroin has dropped 70% since the war started. You know, the only drug that has increased in price since the war started?
Marijuana. Yeah.
Increased by 2,600%.
No, and I believe...
So when I started in 1970, I could buy an ounce of marijuana for $10.
Right.
I bought 10 or 16 of those ounces at the same time, bought a pound. It was $100 a pound. What is it today for a pound of marijuana?
Yeah. Through the roof.
Yeah.
Well, seeing
So you're right. If we legalize, the price will drop right out of the bottom of this thing, and people could get their medical marijuana for a decent price.
Well, seeing that, this is the problem that I noticed back in the 80s, is that the prices of marijuana started going up, and cocaine and all those prices seemed to stay the same. It's like they were pushing people to stop smoking marijuana and start doing harder drugs. I mean, the access to the drugs were...
That's exactly what's happened.
You know, and I'm trying to figure out why. You know, who would... It, you know, you can say conspiracy or whatever, but to me it just seems very odd, and it seemed like it was planned. You know,
I don't think it was conspiracy. I think it was just a matter of
it's
how,
easier.
Enforcement works.
Yeah, and
at the beginning of the war on drugs... The only drug that we were really good at interdicting was marijuana, because any police officer who doesn't smoke, I mean, not even smoke, who doesn't smoke cigarettes,
right?
So that you still have a decent nose. If you stop a car, you know, they'd always say, well, I could smell the marijuana. It's true.
True.
If I stopped a car and it had 50 pounds of pot in the trunk, the guy would roll down the window to hand me out the driver's license, and I'd say, well, how much pot do you have in the car? Because you can smell it. I don't care what it's wrapped in. You can literally smell it. So
true.
We did a great job in interdicting that stuff. And it's very large packages. It's hard to hide, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, very quickly, the drug dealers realized, why should we be trying to smuggle in marijuana, pounds and pounds of marijuana, when we can smuggle in 1 pound of heroin and get more money in return for it than we would in a half a ton of marijuana.
Right, smaller packaging.
So they upgraded to hard drugs,
mm-hmm.
and the price came down for hard drugs. Therefore, more people started using hard drugs. And just to make sure that this was going to happen, we created random drug tests.
Right.
Now, originally, we said we've got to have these random drug tests for law enforcers. And for, not even for law enforcers. We said for people in critical occupations, like pilots and train engineers and things like that. And then they said, well, we also need it for law enforcers. And then they said, well, you know, our children look up to athletes so much that we really shouldn't allow athletes to be using drugs. So they decided to have random testing for professional athlete. And then they decided, well, how about our athletes in colleges? And they decided, or the kids look up to them, so we'll have random testing for them. And then they decided to do it in high schools. And then they decided, well, wait a minute. You know, what about the kids that go out for extracurricular activities? We can have random drug tests for that. And the Supreme Court ruled that this is okay because you choose to do an extracurricular activity. It's not something that you have to do. So it's okay to randomly test the people to do that. So now our kids in high school, with no probable cause whatsoever, if they join the chess club or the French club, they got to pee in a bottle.
Right.
This has become insanity. And our kids in high school know just as well as we do that if you are drug tested and in a random test and you smoked a marijuana cigarette 28 days earlier, you're going to fail that test. But, you know, you could shoot heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and over a long weekend, nobody can tell that you've had that drug.
No, it's gone.
Yeah.
And, again, that's
the
problem.
So we're upgrading these kids to hard drugs.
Well, yeah, in a sense, pushing them that way, maybe not meaning to, but it's...
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at all the statistics and you do any kind of research, you're going to realize that marijuana is going to be a problem because it does stay in your system longer. The other ones don't. I mean, it's like a catch-22. Just keeps going in circles and doesn't get any better. So,
it'll get better once we legalize it. Everything will get better, truly. And speaking of marijuana, we're back in California working on that. This year, there's going to be a referendum vote, and the one we're backing is called Regulate Marijuana Like Wine. I think it's the best
nice.
Thing that the best policy that's come along. I think it will answer a lot of the problems that came out, in 2010 when we tried to create a law that would regulate and control and tax marijuana. This has solved a lot of their problems, and it's so simple. It's just suggesting that marijuana be treated exactly like wine.
Well, and
the same kind of taxing, the same kind of sales, only to adults, only where we say it can be sold. Just treat it the same.
Well, and people want to feel that it is something different, and it's not. You know, it's like
That's
people
right.
want their drug of choice to be okay, and then other people, they're the ones that have the problem. And people need to get over that concept.
And we are getting tremendous backing for this. And October 14th last year, the California Medical Association, which represents more than 35,000 doctors in California, called for the legalization of marijuana for medical and recreational use.
Mm-hmm.
So they're behind this bill completely. An October Gallup poll said that 50% of the population of the entire United States wants to legalize marijuana, and only 46% now want to keep it illegal. So finally, we've come to a majority opinion
right.
legalizing drugs, not just for medical purposes, but for recreational use also.
Right, and still people don't understand it. And the people making the laws don't understand it, especially in the state of Vermont here. I mean, you're having people that know nothing about it trying to make reasonable laws. And that in itself doesn't make sense to me because it's creating more problem in the process in itself. And it gets sort of confusing because they just don't know
and
what
these,
they want to do.
These marijuana myths, Tim, come crashing down more every day. Each new day, it seems, another one falls. And to me, the main reason that the drug warriors always said we can't legalize marijuana is because of the motor vehicle accidents, right?
Mm, right.
But a November 2011 study just compared traffic deaths over time in states with and without medical marijuana changes. And the researchers found that fatal car wrecks dropped by 9% in states that have legalized medical marijuana.
Guys, they're probably smoking over drinking alcohol.
That's right.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah, there are so many myths out there.
That's another myth gone, you know?
Well, it's like the first time I saw medical marijuana used for an issue. The gentleman had Wilson's disease, which is very similar to MS. The myelin sheath wears away and your body doesn't really function as well. He had trouble breathing and walking. And so then he smoked, and I'd never heard him talk before, you know, and he asked me for a drink of water, and I'm like, holy cow, you're talking, you know, and he goes, no joke. And I'm like, what's going on? And he says, well, it basically allows my muscles to relax, which allows me to breathe so I can breathe to talk. And then we went out, and usually you had to, like, kick his foot or grab his pants leg to get his leg to start moving, and he just, like, pushed me away and said, I can do it, and then he starts walking. And, you know, this is a person who was nonverbal, doesn't walk, and they're walking, and the only thing that's allowing them to do this was the marijuana. And one of his caregivers was a former police officer for New York State, and he couldn't get it on a regular basis because of one of his caregivers didn't believe it. But, I mean, when you see it actually working,
yep,
I mean, it's just amazing. And a lot of people don't believe that because, one, they've never seen it. They haven't been around it. They listen to what they're being told instead of actually going out and trying to find the real badness or the goodness. They just, you know, take the spoon-fed reports and go, okay, my government wouldn't lie to me, and they know best, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah, I mean, I guess a change is coming finally, but it's a slow process, which I guess slow can be good because it can be more of a permanent thing and give people more of an understanding. But I don't know. There's a lot of damage going on while the debate continues.
That's for sure.
Hmm.
That's for sure. I myself have witnessed a friend of mine that had, down in New Jersey, had Parkinson's disease.
Hmm.
And his hand would shake that he couldn't write at all. Just could not. You know, you couldn't read anything he wrote by hand. And if he smoked a marijuana cigarette, in about 3 or 4 minutes, he'd pick up a pen and write, and you could read it.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, and again, they want to synthesize it. Again, some company wants to make money on it in a legal way, but not necessarily as good as the original way. You know,
sure.
You know, and that happens with all sorts of medicines.
And the fact of the matter is that it's a lot easier to do it if you synthesize it for the company, I mean,
mm-hmm.
because it's pretty hard to patent a plant, although it can be done. It's not something that's impossible for them to do. And I think if we get legal marijuana, we have to really be aware that this stuff could be patented and some corporation could take over this stuff. So we have to try to create laws that prevent that.
Well, so what do you think nowadays, what is the biggest problem holding back legalization of drugs in this country?
Well,
Same
as it's always been. It's two things. I think it's two things. First thing is the money, the tremendous amount of money to be made. And the second thing is we have used the drug laws traditionally to keep people in their place that we would rather not see get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm talking about is racism. And as far as I'm concerned, all the drug laws have been based on racism or hatred of some ethnicity, including alcohol prohibition. When alcohol prohibition came along, one of the strongest backers for having that prohibition was the Ku Klux Klan. And certainly other people, the people, you know, at that time, just early, just before that occurred, from 1880s up through the early 1900s, we had two huge influxes of immigrants, one group from Italy and another from Ireland. And of course, the Irish like their beer and the Italians like their wine. And if we could make these things illegal, we could do a lot to stop this immigration from occurring. And we know it was racism. At least I know it was racism in my mind because, you know, I told you the first federal law against drugs in this country was the Harrison Anti-Drug Act of 1914, made opiates illegal. Well, the forerunner to that was a law that was created in San Francisco territories 5 years earlier. And that law simply said, no Chinaman shall possess opium. So it was pretty obvious who we were after, right?
Right.
Now, when we made it a federal statute, they removed the word Chinaman, but it still did the same thing because back then 99% of the people that possessed opium were Chinese. And we had invited the Chinese to come to our country to build the railroads because that was such a deadly job. Not only could they get killed by the indigenous people who were fighting for their country, but they were dying of these terrible diseases and cold and of just being overworked. So once the railroads were built, surviving Chinese settled out in the San Francisco territories. And then the real Americans said, hey, they're taking our jobs away. So
sound
we couldn't
familiar.
Deport those folks. We'd invited them in. But if we had the correct laws, we could sure arrest and imprison enough of them that they would just leave voluntarily. And I think that's what it's always been about. It's every time we've created a new law, there's a racism behind it. And when we started the war on drugs, you know, Richard Nixon was the one that created the, even coined the phrase, war on drugs. And it had nothing to do with drugs. It had everything to do with the fact that he was running for the presidency for the second time, and he really thought it nice to win. He knew if he was a strong anti-crime guy, that'd give him a lot of votes. Boy, if he could be in charge of a war on drugs, how those votes would pour in. And he was right.
Right.
Elected, and in his first year, he got the federal government to fund his war on drugs. And as a result, the very first people we were targeted on, I told you, there wasn't really much of a drug problem here, but there was a big problem in Richard Nixon's mind with the anti-war protesters. And strangely enough, a huge percentage of those anti-war protesters were hippies who were smoking pot. And we literally devastated that community by arresting them, infiltrating them with undercover people like myself. And once we became their friends, if they so much as sold us a marijuana cigarette, that was a drug sale, and they were going to prison for 7 years. And they didn't even have to sell it to us. Tim, this is how
just
diabolical
possession.
This was. When I was out there working, our undercover people would, you didn't have to buy something. You know, drug use is a very social thing, especially soft drug use. Six people stand in a circle and you spark up one joint, take two tokes and hand it to the person on the right. And when they handed it to me, I would tend to take a toke on this thing and hand it on around. I was going around again. People were getting high. By the time it comes to me again, it's just a little roach. And when I'd get it, I would act like I'm, as they say, bogarting the roach. But I would actually knocked the flame off the end of it, and tiny portion of the cigarette in my pocket. And that night, I would submit that as evidence.
Evidence, wow.
Evidence that the person who handed it to me was a drug dealer. Because the way the laws are written, it says it is illegal to distribute a controlled dangerous substance, and it lists all the substances. It doesn't say anything in there about money exchanging hands.
So,
and those people were going to prison for 7 years for handing me a cigarette.
Whoa. Yeah, pretty intense policy there.
Yeah.
Well, and it dealt with some other issue. I mean, again, it's not necessarily the drugs. It's all the other things that are around it. And in that case, it was the war movement, which he wanted to sort of quell it because it was causing too much trouble to the administration. And it's another way to deal with it. Sort of like Elvis wanting to be a drug and law enforcement officer. Keeps you guessing. So,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. After
if we have another minute, I'd like to say something to you about the best description of this I've ever seen was in a book by Dan Baum. It's called Smoke and Mirrors, The War on Drugs and the Politics of Failure. And it's his opening paragraph. It was written in 1996. And it says, the country began using police to control the use of certain drugs in 1914, but the war on drugs in name and spirit started during the 1968 presidential campaign when the country discovered how, quote, drugs could stand for a host of troubles too awkward to discuss plainly. The war metaphor worked for Richard Nixon that year. It continues to work for politicians ranging from Jesse Jackson to Jesse Helms, because nearly everyone has found a reason to enlist. Parents appalled by their teens' behavior, police starved for revenue, conservative politicians pandering to their constituents' moral dudgeon, liberal politicians needing a chance to look tough, presidents looking for distractions from scandal, whites and blacks striving to explain the ghetto, editors filling page one, spies and colonels needing an enemy to replace communists. The war on drugs is about a lot of things, but only rarely is it really about drugs.
Exactly. Yep, it's an interesting one. Well, I guess, as you've reminded me, time is running out. So, any final words on this whole
episode? Well, the final words I would put out is, please, I'd ask your audience to go to our website. You can find it at either leap.cc, or if you can't remember that, copssaylegalizeddrugs.com, and join Leap. There is no dues or fees. There's no meetings to attend. We don't release the names of anybody that joins us because we get joined by working police, DEA agents, working politicians. But what we do is we count them. And when we have a million people who say, finally, what these cops, judges, and prosecutors at Leap are saying makes some sense, we're going to go to Washington and we're going to force the government to change these laws. But we've got to have a huge backing.
Yes. Well, and it basically takes, you got to stand up. You know,
that's right.
Because if you don't stand up, people will walk all over you. And that's been proven through history over and over again. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jack. It was a great pleasure talking to you and grasping a better understanding of the situation that we're in.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And you have a great day.
Okay.
All right. Take it easy. Okay. Well, there you go. Another conversation on a topic that we don't like to talk about because it sort of puts you in the spotlight and people go, do they do drugs? Do they promote children getting hooked on drugs and becoming derelict? As long as you hide from a problem and try to put laws on something and don't even understand anything about what you're putting the laws on or the actions, like the drinking age, bringing it to 21. I think that was one of the biggest problems and the stupidest thing the state of Vermont has ever done. And the country doesn't deal with the problem, creates the problem, creates binge drinking, binge drug use, out of control, using something because you don't know when you're going to get it again. Opposed to having it around, do I want to eat that chocolate bar or not? You have a choice. As humans, we're supposed to be intelligent, which I'm finding to be not so. And it's something that we need to deal with. Face up to it. Educate yourself. Just don't go, oh, drugs are so bad. I don't like them. I don't know why they're there, and those people that use them are disgusting. Some of your biggest leaders in the military, the U.S. government, and other governments around the world use them illegally. Yet they get that free out-of-jail pass because they know, they're in the know, and they're allowed to do it. So laws should be for everyone, and the money should be taken out of it in the illegal sense because there's money and there's taxes involved in it. You know, fact is fact. Capitalism is based on cash. Socialism is based on cash. So if you take the cash aspect out of illegal drugs, I think you'd have a little less killing. But that's my opinion. And as always, the preceding program represented the opinions of producing participants and did not represent the views of WM or WLP or its license holder Roots Work or MRVTV.